Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August the 9th, 1999, and Koinonia Fireside Room this evening is Ralph Milton's session, God's Gift of Laughter, number 99-6. Let's listen in.
All right. First of all, as miracles go, it doesn't rank with the parting of the Red Sea or changing water into wine. But do you remember the broken biffy aboard one of the first U.S. space shuttle flights? I think it was a miracle, a very small one, but a miracle still. Because some miracles are about God giving us a wink and a gentle poke in the ribs, and in the process, the spiritual gift of laughter. Every once in a while, when we humans, either individually or collectively, get swelled heads, something happens that reminds us we are human, we mess up, and if we're lucky, we can laugh about it. The American people are justifiably proud of the technological accomplishments involved in a space shuttle. They should be. But it seemed to be a bit of divine poetic justice when those superbly trained astronauts in a billion-dollar craft had to contend with a busted biffy. God has put down the mighty from their thrones, said Mary, Jesus' mother, in the Bible. The mighty astronauts were put down from their thrones, so to speak, while the whole world giggled. They needed a plumber up there, and I bet God giggled too. After I'd been boasting to Bev, my wife, about a new promotion, my teenage daughter, Carrie, who had been listening with very mild interest, walked up behind my chair, ran her finger around the edge of my bald spot. She said, "Dad, you've got a hole in your head." I don't think my daughter was trying to bring me back down to earth, but that's exactly what she did. I think God had a chuckle over it, and a few days later, I did too. I wonder if God created teenage daughters to keep their dad's feet on the ground. An audiovisual expert from New York, the woman called me. It was at a prestigious It was at a prestigious conference in Chicago. We were in one of those big old churches, the kind with the long center aisle slanting down the front, the kind brides love to walk down. We were to see a film, but the projectionist didn't show. The woman in charge of the program asked me if I could run a projector. After all, I was there representing a media consulting outfit from New York. A piece of cake, I said, sure. Hundreds of people had gathered and were waiting. The church was full. To fill time while I threaded the projector, the woman went up into the pulpit and said how grateful they were to have an audiovisual expert from New York to help them out. She used that phrase several times, and I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy it. Well, you know, that little toggle thing on the front reel of a movie projector, the one that holds the full roll of film in place? The lights went off, the projector came on, and the front roll of film flipped off with a great clatter and unrolled all the way down that long, sloping aisle to the front. I turned the projector off and the lights came on just in time to show a red-faced audiovisual expert from New York winding up the film from the front of the church to the back. Following the film, there was a closing meditation. The scripture? You guessed it. Mary's poem from the Bible. God has put down the mighty from their thrones. Lying on my hotel room bed that night, my face still burning with embarrassment, I could hear, in the darkness around me, a soft and gentle and holy chuckle. If you attended the Canadian Bible Society annual dinner in Winnipeg back in 1961, you would have heard me make a very important speech. The printed word is passé, and books as such will be unknown in a decade, I said. I thought I was being prophetic. A few others must have thought so too, because the speech was printed in 5 magazines and 3 countries. Now, almost 4 decades later, having founded and retired from Canada's largest religious publishing company, this writer of books feels himself again embraced by a gentle and holy chuckle. Now, there are some things I believe about a sense of humor. First of all, I believe that a sense of humor is a means of grace. And you notice I said a means of grace, not the means of grace. It is one of the means of grace that God has given us in this vast cornucopia of gifts through which we can use to live our lives creatively. I also believe that humor is a very much underutilized gift in our lives generally and in the church particularly. It is something that doesn't just come naturally, like, you know, the color of your hair or something like that. Humor is a learned art and a perfected skill. Humor, I believe, is the opposite of despair. Conrad Hyers has been my mentor in this whole field, and he says laughter is not the opposite of seriousness. Laughter is the opposite of despair. And if you want to see an example of that, the business of laughter being the opposite of despair rather than the opposite of seriousness, watch children at play. They are absolutely serious in what they are doing, though they may be laughing and giggling and having a wonderful time. A sense of humor has not much to do with the ability to tell jokes. There are some people who have a great skill at telling jokes, but they do not have a sense of humor. They use humor as a weapon. A sense of humor is much more gentle than that, and I'm going to say a few more things about that later on. A sense of humor has everything to do with your image of yourself and who you are and your relationship with God. Finally, number seven, the Bible is a rich repository of humor. We almost never think of the Bible as a comic book, but it is. How many of you were here for the Bible study this morning? In the second session, we were told about how Jesus became ritually unclean in order to go and heal the squeaky clean daughter of the synagogue. And while that is profound, that is also very humorous. You know, this is the whole accepted process turned upside down. Okay. Humor helps with a lot of really practical things. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever been on a tour of Europe? Mm-hmm. You too, Michael. Good for you. Okay, a few years ago, maybe almost 10 years ago, I guess, Bev and I were asked to lead one of these tour groups, and it was the year of the Oberammergau Passion Play. They put an extra one on for some particular reason to draw millions more tourists and so forth. So anyway, just in case you ever are called upon to do this, I'm going to read you a very learned treatise called Toilet Training Tourists. What travel agents never tell you is that North American tourists going to Europe need to be housebroken. Mostly that involves learning one critical life skill, to laugh at yourself. Without that, the Belgians can reduce you to a bowl of emotional jelly in a week. The Italians can do it in a day. European culture has great variety, fine wines, great music, and incomprehensible toilets. American civilization has only two kinds of wine, red and white, two kinds of music, country and old-time fiddlers, and there isn't much variety in toilets either. Europeans want the necessities of life to be interesting. North Americans want them to be functional. Europeans in charge of getting stuff in and out of human bodies are mad, slightly drunk artists from the left bank of the Seine. North Americans in charge of the ingress and egress of food and drink are nerdy types with computers. Now, the travel agents know all this, but they keep it a secret and they recruit unsuspecting folks with leadership qualities to be tour group leaders. Someone has to guide these naive North Americans who want their food pronounceable and their toilets flushable into a world where food must have elan and the toilets must offer a challenge. Successful tour group leaders combine the skills of sheepdog, den mother, and priest, but above all, a mentor in the fine art of life. Tour group leaders must keep the group laughing, preferably at themselves. Bev and I led a gaggle of 39 tourists around Europe in one of those, if this is Tuesday, it must be Belgium, kind of junkets. Now, led is an overstatement. Bev walked at the head of the pack, throwing body blocks and temper tantrums, tripping, doing whatever was necessary to slow them down. I ran back and forth across the back of the herd like a Scottish sheepdog, nipping at heels, barking at laggards, and generally making myself the most unpopular person in the group. The food was not too much of a problem because tour buses only stop at places where the waiters have North American sight. And so they give them a steak sandwich and coffee or a hamburger and Coke, regardless of what they may order. As long as we could keep them away from small restaurants up dark alleys where the waiters have black mustaches and dirty aprons, our 39 tourists did just fine on food. But the toilets. Europeans regard toilets as an art form, not a utility. Theater art primarily, because what could be better comedy than North Americans trying to cope with European plumbing? Until we got the point of it all, we found ourselves the butt of the joke. Toilet training tourists is a matter of attitude, not technology. One of the funniest scenes is watching a tourist try to get into a European toilet. You need a coin. So you stand in line for 45 minutes to change your money from dollars into whatever. Then as you desperately fumble to find the right coin to put in the slot, you discover you have every other coin except the specific one required. So you give up and quietly wet your pants. It was the women on our tour bus who worked out a strategy. Whenever the bus stopped in a new country, which seemed to be every hour or so, they would charge into the biffy en masse and line up, having sent a delegate, preferably a young husband with a good bladder, to the place where they change money and with instructions, get one sample of every coin minted in the last 50 years. One of those coins would fit the slot. Now, once one woman got into the cubicle, she would hold the door open for the next one, and so on, so that in effect, the whole bunch could go doo-doo on one dime. Was that ripping off the folks who owned the bathrooms? Probably. But in a contest between distended bladders and ethics, bladders win every time. And the women learned to do it with such triumphant whoops and so much laughter, even the Germans offered a grudging admiration. The more progressive countries posted guards in each bathroom to whom you paid your florins or francs or razbucniks. All the guards in the women's bathroom were men, and vice versa. Now, speculation on the bus had it that since the job didn't pay much, there needed to be fringe benefits. If the main reason for European toilets is to entertain Europeans, then what better way to do it than with a bit of good-natured voyeurism? We almost lost one of our men, a retired hypertensive banker, to this system. It was in Italy where the toilets presented even more of a challenge than in France, if that's possible. He came staggering back to the bus, his face beet red, hyperventilating, not seeing anything even slightly funny about anything. That's supposed to be the men's camp, right? There's this big fat babe in there right in the men's john, and she went, I don't know, 10,000 lira or something, so I give her all my money, and she gives me four tiny little sheets of brown paper, and then she stands right outside the cubicle, right outside, and I couldn't do a damn thing. Half an hour later, after we had brought him down from the edge of an aneurysm, I visited the same facility. the staff, all women, were still laughing. Bev, my wife, also enjoyed an exciting toilet adventure in a busy piazza in Rome. Asking the question that most tourists ask most often, she was directed to a stainless steel bunker right in the center of a traffic circle around a small park. It didn't seem to have a door, but it had coin slots and a sign which asked in four languages for 8 million lira. That's about 25 cents. She dropped in the money and voila, a stainless steel door slid open silently and revealed the sparkling clean facilities within. The call of nature being stronger than her sense of foreboding, Bev went in. Silently the door slid shut. I stood outside and wondered if I would ever see my beloved. Inside, Bev discovered that once the call of nature had been answered, her anxiety took over. There was no handle on the door, no button to press, no lever to pull. There was no window to wave out of, no phone to call on, no sign in any language which indicated what to do once you were done. There was only one tiny lever. It said flush in seven languages. Since she couldn't think of anything else to do, she flushed. Silently, the door slid open. Sobbing our joy and relief, we rushed into each other's arms. As we walked away, we saw a bench on which were perched four elderly men. It was situated exactly where they would get the best view when the door slid open. All the other benches in the piazza were empty. You know, said Bev, I usually flush before I do myself up. This must be the best show in town. And then, she, give her credit, she managed a laugh, and so did I. The old men were laughing too, this time with us rather than at us. The toilets had done their job for the Italian men and this Canadian couple. All of us learned a little of the fine art of life. Who says Europeans only tolerate North Americans because of their money? So that's sort of a way of trying to show you the use of humor. Because while that, of course, you know, when you are writing these things, you overdraw these things and you extend them and you refine them and you make them bigger and more dramatic than they really were. That's the writer's art. But the truth is that a sense of humor and knowing how to use it is absolutely essential when you are doing things such as running a tour group or managing a place like Holden Village, if any of you here are staff. Now, one of the things I am not saying here, folks, is I am not saying laugh your troubles away. Laughter is an inappropriate response to a lot of things. But sometimes, even in the midst of the most desperate things, laughter is possible. About 4 years ago, we lost our son, Lloyd. Lloyd was suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome and had a very difficult life all the way along. And eventually he took his own life. It was a very sad and desperate time for us. But I found comfort in a gift that he had given us. You see, Lloyd had a quiet but undeveloped sense of humor. And one Christmas, he got me one of these old-fashioned taxi meters. And he said, Dad, you're always complaining that you don't have enough time at the office and people come in and talk too long. So what I want you to do is to put this on your desk, and when people come in, you just put the flag down and this thing goes tick, tick, tick real loud. And he thought that might help. And I've had that in my office ever since as a reminder of a gift that this young man had and that a gift that I miss very much. And it brings laughter, even in the midst of the tears that still come. There is a wonderful verse in Proverbs 17:22, and it comes out best in the King James Bible. Laughter doeth good like a medicine, but a broken spirit drieth the bones. I like that. Laughter doeth good like a medicine, but a broken spirit drieth the bones. There are has been a whole science of laughter that has developed in the medical community. They often describe it as a good belly laugh is an internal jogging. It is a good way to exercise your abdominal muscles. Your heart rate goes up and your blood pressure increases, and then it goes back down to base levels and deep relaxation. There's from one of the scholarly journal, this quote: humor and laughter significantly increase the levels of salivary immunoglobulin A, a vital immune system protein, which is the body's first line of defense against respiratory illnesses. I have no idea what that means, but I think it may say that if you laugh a lot, you don't get as many colds. Are any medical people in here? And so the question is, does humor heal? Because like many other things, people have gone around and talked about humor as healing, as if somehow if you laugh enough, you can cure cancer or heart disease. And that is manifestly wrong and unfair, because it doesn't work like that. But humor does heal, in the sense that it provides a cure, and we have to distinguish between a cure and healing. Humor provides a cure because, or a healing, because it helps to provide a stronger, healthier sense of who you are, and it also helps in your relaxation. It helps your body fight whatever it is that's attacking your body. It doesn't cure anything. Now, some of you may know the name of Norman Cousins, do you? Yeah, he was the editor of the Saturday Review of Literature, I think. He had an incurable collagen disease called ankylosing spondylitis. Now, here's what he wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the most prestigious of the medical journals. If negative emotions produce negative chemical changes in the body, wouldn't the positive emotions produce positive chemical changes? Is it possible that love, hope, faith, laughter, confidence, and the will to live have therapeutic value? So, Norman Cousins had a disease that at that time was incurable. And so he booked himself out of the hospital and into a hotel room across the street. He continued with all the therapies that his doctors recommended. He hired a nurse, or several nurses, to be there full time. And then, in addition to the conventional medical stuff, he brought in tapes of Candid Camera and Laurel and Hardy and all kinds of things. And he says, it worked. I made the joyous discovery that 10 minutes of genuine belly laughter had an anesthetic effect and would give me at least 2 hours of pain-free sleep. And then following each of these laughing sessions, his sedimentation rate was measured and there was a drop of 5 to 9 points. It was cumulative and there was a return to normal levels. And once again, I don't know what that means. But the media oversimplified the story. They said Norman Cousins had cured himself with laughter. Norman Cousins never said that. Norman Cousins said that laughter was an important component and an important asset in his healing. And so this is something to remember. There is absolutely no doubt in medical circles that a sense of humor and the use of humor is helpful in the healing process, whether you're fit as a fiddle or whether you're lying on your bed and in deep difficulty. Humor is fun, it enhances the health, and you know, that's very helpful because my doctor, I have a really cranky doctor. His among other things, he specializes in sports medicine. Now, what am I doing going to a doctor who specializes in sports medicine? Well, he didn't always do that, and I was with him when he was just an ordinary doctor, and he still, he still says he'll treat me, sort of thing. I like him; he's a friend. But he insists on stupid things like exercise. My idea of exercise is like breaking a bottle of wine open and telling jokes for a couple of hours. He doesn't think that. He also says that sex is good exercise, but then he prescribes a medicine that has the absolute negative effect. uh, some people have said that humor is tragedy plus time. Tragedy plus time. Something really bad happens to you. And you sort of sit there and you cry and you fuss and you get mad about it. But a few days, weeks, months, years later, you can sometimes laugh about it. And if you can, then you know that the healing is complete. So one of the tricks is to try and use humor by condensing that time. Something bad happens and you say, now, hey, what if I could just sort of think, how am I going to think about this in a couple of years? If you could do that mental leap, you can sometimes do the laughing right now. Now, the reality is that most of the troubles that we have don't result from big problems. They result from small pinches. That doesn't hurt, does it?
No.
No. Does that hurt?
No.
Does that hurt?
No.
Does that hurt?
No.
Does that hurt?
No.
Does that hurt?
No.
Does that hurt?
No.
It's starting to get uncomfortable, isn't it? Yeah. This is like small irritations in your life. A neighbor whose dog barks all night. Or a spouse who keeps messing up the bedroom. My wife has a spouse like that. These small irritations. Now, this is where humor can be used very effectively. In those locale problems, if you can bring a sense of humor to bear on them, then they will not accumulate to the point where something blows. You see, if I did that for a long enough time, I would totally bruise that arm and be drawing blood. No, seriously, it would. I mean, if you just keep doing it, you keep doing it. It's a small thing. Like, it's like the old traditional water torture. This is a wonderful way to drive people mad. They get chained under a little thing that drops a single drop of water on your forehead every couple of minutes. And after those first few drops, don't bother, you can carry on, but eventually it drives people absolutely mad. Well, humor is a wonderful antidote to those kinds of locale problems. The big, huge problems usually need tears before laughter can come in on them. Now, where am I going? Genuine laughter one of the things we need to realize about laughter is that there are such things as clean jokes and dirty jokes. Now, first of all, before we, just a little side trip here, talk about swearing. You've all heard swearing, right? Can you think of any swear words that do not have to do with religion, sex, or the elimination of bodily wastes? Think of any? You see, I've challenged I don't know how many audiences on this, and nobody has ever come up with a swear word. And the read, pardon me?
Usta.
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 Usta. That's a Norwegian.
Oh, yes. I should have said in English, all right?
Sure, come up with one, and modify it.
Yeah, sure. Well, yeah. No, I know of some swearing in Low German, and I know of some swearing in Cebuano Visaya, the Philippine dialect, that are not in those categories. But in our North American culture, okay, I'll narrow it even more. That's where, and the reason I believe that that is true is that those are the areas in which we have the most problem, that we feel most uncomfortable about. It's teenagers that do the most of this swearing for the most part, and if you listen to them, you'll realize that they are having trouble coming to terms with their sexuality, their religion, and their whole bodies, which are giving them trouble, and that's one of the reasons why they do that. Now, the same is true, but not quite so in quite such a limited form in terms of humor. Humor is much broader than that. But most of the questionable humor that we have comes from jokes about those kinds of things. And the reason we tell jokes that way, the reason why people, locker room jokes and so forth happen, is because we are having trouble talking about these things, and so we do it via jokes. I believe there is such a thing as a dirty joke. But a dirty joke isn't one that necessarily has something to do with sex. There's lots of good, clean sex jokes. Like the one about the boy who went to school and came back home, and the mother said, "What did you learn in school today?" And we're studying about sex. And, well, what did you learn? Well, I learned what they did and how they did it, but I haven't figured out why. A dirty joke is one that has a victim. Now think about that. Most of the jokes that we tell about ethnic jokes, or gender-based jokes, or so many of the sexually-based jokes have a victim. Somebody is the object of the joke. And so if to ask yourself whether a joke is dirty or clean, you need to say, is there a victim? If there is a victim, then it is a dirty joke. All right? I talk about that for a long time, but I'm not going to go. Now, the nature of humor. Humor is not the ability to tell jokes. My grandmother, I don't think, ever told a joke, nor did she ever understand one, for that matter. But when we would go to see her, she always seemed to have her hands in flour. This is my childhood memory, okay? And she would come up and she would put a little flour on the end of my nose, you know, and then take me to the mirror so I could laugh at myself. And my dad, who was born in a suit, she would go and put powder on his nose too, and sometimes she'd actually get him to laugh, and that was quite a challenge. So, okay, let me see. Holy smokes. All right. There is lots of humor in the Bible too, and I should have talked about that. The book of Jonah, my friends, read it again if you think about it as a book of humor. Think how much trouble we would have saved ourselves if we had learned that there is so much good humor in the Bible. The book of Jonah. Jonah gets this call from God and doesn't want to go. He goes in the absolute opposite direction and takes a boat to Tarshish, which is sort of like the symbol for Timbuktu. It's the end of nowhere. And then the sailors have this great storm comes up. God causes the storm to come up, and Jonah winds up getting thrown over the side because the sailors figure that Jonah himself says that he's responsible. And this God brings a great big fish, doesn't say anything about a whale, a big fish that swallows Jonah, and suddenly inside the fish, Jonah gets religious, and he starts praying a long, tedious prayer, and the fish barfs him out on the shore, and God says, "Go to Nineveh." And Jonah says, I'm going, all right already, and he goes and he preaches the shortest sermon on record, everybody is converted, and Jonah sulks. And in the end, God says, "Hey, look, I care about those people of Nineveh, just like I care about you and a plant and stuff like that." But it was a humorous parable, a parable in the tradition of Jesus' parables, made up to show the Hebrew people that God was the God of the hated Ninevites that were beating up on them all the time, as well as the God of the Hebrews. There is a lot of other humor in the Bible too, and I could go into that. But the whole theme, the recycling theme of the Bible, is the continual story of the one least expected who somehow succeeds. This is a theme. If you read Joseph Campbell's stuff, you'll find that he says this is an archetype that goes through all literature of the one who is least expected to succeed. This is there in terms of the large theme of the Hebrew people, a little motley race of Bedouins with whom God makes a covenant, to the story of David, the man from the smallest tribe, from the smallest family, and the youngest one, to the story of Jesus, who should never have succeeded. And the whole story is one of those least expected succeed. And that is a fundamentally humorous kind of a theme. Okay, I'm going to read you one little piece here. Where am I? Okay. This has to do with biblical humor. It's a marvelous, wonderful, wise, loving, practical joke. Christmas, the Nativity. There's God down through the centuries listening to the prophecies about the Messiah. Some of them were wonderful and beautiful and spoke the mind of God. Others thundered away about the conqueror, the one who'd come on a white horse with sword and shield, a leader that would be better and tougher than King David. So God gave them the gift they so badly needed, but not the gift they expected. It was King David, too, they wanted. It was a tiny baby they got. What a hoot! They wanted power, so God gave them the power of weakness. They wanted a conqueror, so God gave them love that conquers all. It must have been good for a heavenly chuckle, or perhaps even a belly laugh, if a belly laugh is possible for a God who is spirit. It was not the laughter of derision. It was the laughter of a loving, gentle parent waking up long before the kids on Christmas morning, waking up in anticipation of the face of the child when that special gift is opened, the child who receives so much more than it ever dared ask for in the letter to Santa. The laughter of God is the laughter of a pleased-as-punch parent who receives the Christmas thank you hug of a delighted child. And the joke comes back every year. Okay, that's about all I have to say. Anybody got any problems? Comments? Anything you want to say? We have about a minute left before I have to let you out of here. That's always interesting when you throw it open to the floor and nobody says anything. You wonder whether they're all mad or whether there's just not anything you want to say.
Did you design your shirt?
My shirt. Well, this is comes from my son-in-law. I can't spell to save my soul, and my son-in-law knows it. And I opened this, he made it as a Christmas gift. He's an artist, okay? He made this for me as a Christmas gift, and I opened it up and I read, "Bad spellers of the world unite." He said, "Read it again, Dad." "Bad spellers of the world unite. What's the problem?" He says, "Read it again." Oh. And this is the kind of spelling error that the spell checkers do not catch, and I make them all the time. And so that's why that's why I like wearing it, because it's a joke that we share. Okay, tomorrow I'll wear another T-shirt, and we'll prize to the person who first gets the point of it.
Going to eat early breakfast?
Well, Michael may have a head start on us because we're living in the same place, and you could look at it and maybe you could get it before anybody else does, eh? Okay, we'll see you tomorrow, or if you want to come back tomorrow, may not be anybody here, but if you want to come back tomorrow, when is it, 10:45? Just a minute. 10:45, same place, same station, yeah. And tomorrow I'm going to be talking about the gender wars. Okay?